It's been almost 20 years since X left us hanging. Fandom swelled and waned as its hiatus stretched from tense to irrelevance. When we began our journey through Tokyo Babylon and X, we talked about how much our era of apocalyptic thinking, economic disparity, and social consciousness has in common with the era that inspired these works. In some ways, that makes them especially poignant. In others, it makes them show their age. They are still beautiful and significant, and leave us with so much to talk about.
We're Lucy and Robin, and we'll be your guides through Clamp's Wonderland.
Okay, let's start this probably very long episode with a check-in. How are we doing?
Oh my goodness. How are you, Lucy?
I'm very, very tired. I was lucky enough to get in on the vaccinations happening at my roommate's, the retirement home where she works. They had an extra vaccine, and I had a 10-minute window in which she was like, if you want one, get over here. They need to use them up. So I'm very, very thankful, but now my arm hurts.
Oh, man.
And I'm kind of tired, which may or may not be related. It's also a Sunday. I could just be tired.
Yeah, you've been working really hard. Mm-hmm. I've been working really hard, too. We have put so many hours into this episode. It is ridiculous, and I still am, worried that it's not enough, and it'll have to be enough, because we gotta be done.
Yeah, great.
In the middle of all of that, I had two rat health crises.
Yeah.
And so my rat Lurky got a terrible wound because he got in a stupid fight with his stupid friends. So he's fine. It took us days of worrying about him and trying to get him to an emergency room, and he's fine. But his little buddy Murky died completely out of the blue. He had heart failure, and we didn't even know he had a heart problem.
Mm.
So I am a little heartbroken and messed up. So there's a chance that today's episode will make me cry, and that's fine.
Yeah.
This is how life is.
I mean, to be fair, that's a danger anyway.
Yeah, no, exactly. This is a pretty tear-jerky topic. And then on top of it, I'm just a little bad. So I do have Office Max. My rat Max is in the office with me while we're recording.
I love that.
Yeah, he's a good boy.
So as we go into this, I wanted to remind us all that back in the beginning, Robin said that in the first X episode that she thought we'd get through these volumes faster than Tokyo Babylon. And yeah, that did not happen.
Oh, man.
I do think we've learned our lesson and gotten into a good stride with this format. No longer going to fight. We're going to accept that the recaps are useful and interesting, and I really enjoy writing them. And we're just going to assume that one volume of manga can easily take an episode to cover, and that's fine. And maybe someday we'll go back and do something like that to Reg Veda, because man, that was a rush.
Oh yeah. Maybe even revisiting Tokyo Babylon? Okay, I learned so much from covering X, and I grew a lot as a person. I came down hard on Tokyo Babylon, which is my favorite comic. My favorite thing. I make comics for a living. Tokyo Babylon is my favorite thing. But all of that came from this really defensive place. I have an easier time discussing what is so spectacular and even what doesn't quite work for me about X. So I have some regrets with just how I was covering stuff back in the day. I had to re-listen to all of the X episodes to write this one, and I saw how much we hit our stride. But I'm also a little mortified by how much I talk, so I'm going to work on that.
No, I think you're fine. I don't feel like you talk much more than me. I feel like I talk plenty. But I do agree that our format really, solidified over the course of X. Can you believe that when we started, we hadn't even been doing the podcast for a full year yet?
I cannot, in fact, believe that. That blows my mind.
Yeah, it just feels very, very wild to me.
Yeah, we stopped saying meaty topic or get to the meat of it so much since Will begged us not to. And I noticed that happened somewhere in there. I also wanted to say rest in peace to the late, great James Randi, who we brought up as a debunker of supernatural bullshit, and he died very recently, which is a big loss.
Oh, yeah, that's too bad.
Yeah.
All right. So, we've covered the manga, the unpublished half volume, the theatrical film, and the TV anime. X was popular in its heyday. 12 million books being sold is not a statistic anyone can brush off, especially anyone who knows how abysmal book sales actually are. It also had a lot of peripheral materials that helped promote and merchandise it, especially around the film and the TV anime. And so we've dug into a few of those for you guys.
First off are the audio dramas, which were released to promote the film in 1996. They all star the voice actors in the movie and were written by Okawa.
And these are actually a lot of fun, and I wish they were more accessible. But I want to give a big shout out to Anile and Diamonds for Coat Champagne on Twitter for helping us track down the transcripts, and also for your general eagerness to just discuss stuff. It's always fun.
Hey!
And I've reblogged these transcripts on Tumblr, and they should be under the resources tab of our Tumblr page if you want to kind of go and read them for yourself. So there are seven of these with two characters each, so there's one for each of the dragons. Most of them have a monologue bookending their section, so it kind of like begins and ends. And then there's kind of a little dramatized scene sort of in the middle there, and it's usually kind of addressed as if it's like a letter or a diary entry or sometimes like a voicemail. And they were all very good, and I think they would have been especially fascinating if you listened to them around when the movie came out. But a lot of the info that isn't from the manga was actually used later in the TV show, which I think is really cool and makes a lot of sense. For instance, we get to learn a little more about Satsuki's past than we do in the manga, and we get to see the scene where Katen and Aoki meet for the first time when he visits her at work for doing research.
Awesome.
Yeah, I think that's really cool and kind of makes me feel better about like the anime pulling from those things, because it was actually more like original content than I realized at the time, which is cool.
Yeah, I know that Okawa, I mean, they always say that they have these like dossiers that they write on for all the characters before they, you know, pitch a book or start making a comic. And I think it's really interesting that like, oh yeah, some of this information is probably stuff that's just been sitting around. So she was able to use it and be really consistent in all these different takes because it was there.
Yeah, so I think they are all really cool and kind of, it is, like you said, a really good kind of show of how much information they just sort of have. And most of them, like I've said, are kind of stuff we'd already seen before, but a few of them do stand out, so we're kind of going to give some highlights. The Subaru one is especially bittersweet, as you might imagine. There's not really that much new information in it, but it's always nice to see more of his perspective, especially like more of, you know, older Subaru's perspective. He talks about how he misses his sister, but doesn't count the time since her death, since he doesn't want to tie down her soul with his grieving. And I think in the anime, it even came up at one point where it was like the 7-year reunion and he wasn't really going to do the normal ceremonies around that.
Yeah.
So in this, he also mentions how he was surprised by how much Seishiro remembered about him during their meeting at Nakano, even though he's still sure that he has not changed Seishiro's life in any way. I know.
My heart.
In Nataku's file, we learn a few details that we had kind of wondered about. Apparently, they were born only a little over a year before the beginning of X, and took 30 years to create them. If we knew this, which we might, I had definitely forgotten the details, so that's nice.
No, I don't think we were given those numbers.
Cool. In Kusanagi's file, we learn that apparently Yuzuniha has a high tolerance for alcohol, and this is not because they're like drinking together or anything, they just get ice cream. But because she mentions how her grandmother would have her drink with her, and she
That's
can
so
drink
cute.
Like, I think it's like 7 of those little sake bottles or something.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah. And this is really interesting, but man, is it wild to learn this as someone from the US where drinking has like so much stigma associated with it. Like, I cannot imagine an American thing with like a 14-year-old or 16-year-old girl talking about how her grandmother drinks with her.
I mean, we say that, but I have some really fond memories of my grandmother handing me a Corona first thing in the morning when I came down to help do some sort of cooking project for a big family gathering. So, I don't know. Some of us drink with their grandmas.
Yeah, well, my mom and dad would definitely let me have wine on like Thanksgiving and stuff, especially once I was in high school. But it's just not a thing you see in our media much because it's going to like corrupt the youth or something.
Oh, yeah, we actually have like standards and practices type laws about showing minors drinking in the US in media. Yeah.
So in the Yuto file, we learn that Yuto has a younger sister, Tomoe, who apparently is also from the barely starred Hagusen Senki that Suo and him are also from, which was a cool detail to know. Apparently they make a cameo in Clamp School Detectives and Duke Leon like in the background somewhere that I don't think we saw, and now I kind of want to reread those. So
oh yeah, we'll go find it. It'll be great.
But really, the most interesting file is Seisho's, and it's another example of just how much you can tell Okawa and the others loved this character, unsurprising since we definitely do too. We learn that he didn't meet his mother until he was 9, which I had not assumed, so that was definitely, like, a new information for me.
Yeah.
Apparently he was raised in Kanazawa, and she lived in Tokyo, in a room that was basically a prison, complete with bars. And it's lightly implied that she was only let out when it was time to kill someone. And there's some, like, weird sexual chemistry between them that wasn't not there in the manga, but is definitely a bit stronger here. And coming out of that scene, we also learn that he's seen dead inside Subaru for the first time, and despite the changes, he still thinks his eyes are as pure as always. So, yeah, I'm basically dead now. How are you?
I'm good. I looked into the video games.
Yeah.
There are two of them. They were both released in 2002 as tie-ins to the TV anime, which they take art and voices, etc. directly from. One of them is a card battle game for the Wonder Swan, which was a delightfully bullshit sentence to get to say. It's called X, Card of Fate. It's like, what if the X characters were having a Yu-Gi-Oh plot instead of psychic occult battles? I do not have a whole lot to say about it. You can find a little bit of footage of it on YouTube. The Wonder Swan is not, I mean, like, it's kind of import only for most of the world, so is this not easy to get your hands on? It's not like a super important lost media thing, though. Like, it's out there. You can find this. The Wonder Swan, for those of you who don't know, was a cheap handheld console made by Bandai to compete with the Game Boy Color in, like, the year 2000. It had impressive capabilities if you didn't care about extremely limited memory and performance. It did not really threaten the Game Boy. And it's interesting. Like, it's interesting to hear the, like, tinny little MIDI music for this and how much they really did reuse animation from the TV show, but, like, in a tiny little format, very pixely. It's kind of amazing. The other game was a PlayStation 3D fighting game called X Unmei no Sentaku. It used the Psychic Force game engine, so you have, like, a square screen-fitting Kekkei-like space to fight in, but you kind of float and use the X and Y axis instead of just the X axis, like old Street Fighter and stuff. It looks pretty extra for the era. Pretty detailed character models, going for realistic if blocky proportions. It uses assets from the show to add cutscenes and stuff. I will tell you that Kamui has a special move that, like, throws someone onto a glowing cross and he drives the sacred sword through their heart.
Oh.
So that's a localization nightmare. Yeah. And is why it did not get localized, I'm sure. Each character gets a bit of an ending for their own, like, versus campaign, following both the TV and manga stuff vaguely, which is cool, but it has two endings, just to shovel more endings onto this pile. It lets you choose Kamui or Fuma for, like, a main playthrough. So if you choose Kamui, you get the same ending as the anime, basically. He sacrifices himself for the world, and Fuma is returned to his true self so he and the remaining dragons can gather around Kamui's grave and mourn him. But if you choose Fuma, you get a sequence of all the dragons of Earth killing the dragons of Heaven, which is rough to watch, and I did not have a good time of that. And then Kamui, I think he still gets his final wish, returning Fuma to himself. But this time, only Fuma is left to mourn him.
Oh, man.
So, yeah. So how many endings is that? I think we just piled another ending on.
Yeah, that is far too many. I have to say that that Fuma ending sounds like it may be the really, truly worst ending, like, of all of them. Like, you definitely messed up something to get to that ending. Like, poor dude. So we were only able to find out about these due to the power of the internet. And we're also always excited to hear about what other fellow Clamp fans have uncovered. Robin has a film manga that uses captures of the movie to tell the whole story in a comic panel layout format.
Yeah, it's garbage. I couldn't not buy it, though. I was at a con and someone had piles of old art books, and this was one of the things I just picked up. I think I also grabbed my nice oversized Mikitan of Wonderland book from this. It was maybe Sacramento or Vegas. Do you remember traveling, Lucy? Also, thanks to my pal, fellow comic artist L. Skinner of Missing Monday fame, I have this wild CD that has, like, Ashura, Kamui, and Kohaku from Wish on the cover in a recording studio.
Oh.
But I think we'll save that for Wish, because there aren't enough Wish things, so we'll pile that one on.
Yeah, that sounds like a good plan.
The fun part of doing a wrap-up episode like this is we can deep dive into everything we kept putting off, especially things like symbolism. I said I was keeping track of some of the symbols and visuals in X, and I did. And we also kept saying we were going to talk about the tarot cards. We ended up with some insights from that. But I think before we get to that, we wanted to maybe, I don't know, clear up and address a few things from listener comments, right, Lucy?
Yeah, let's get into it.
So, first of all, I think we may have even mentioned this. I'm pretty sure we addressed it on Twitter, but Twitter is not the podcast. So we had a correction from Jay. Once upon a time, Lucy wrote, we said, I'm pretty sure I made this mistake, though, which makes me very embarrassed. Said something about Subaru's name coming from the Pleiades constellation, not the Big Dipper. And Hokudos is, of course, from the North Star. So we mentioned this somewhere, but thank you for the correction. We got, you know, for the record, here we go.
Yeah, I think it was your mistake the first time, but then when I tried to fix it on Twitter, I also did it wrong in a different way, so we both
hopefully this time we're good.
So we also had Tully Tree point out the times that Fuma goes dark Kamui is when he's touching Kamui's blood, which is really chilling and pretty cool to think about, though they did also point out that Kamui does bleed a lot, so it might not be as causational as it sounds.
Yeah, I was really intrigued by that, and so when I was going back through for my research, I tracked it, and it doesn't actually correlate perfectly. I really wanted it to, but it doesn't. There's plenty of times where he's switching that are not times where he's touching Kamui's blood or anyone else's blood. Plus, one of the times he's touching blood when he switches is his own mom's blood. I think those are just shocking visuals to help reinforce the idea that this is not our normal Fuma. It might even be a red herring, since they did draw attention to it with the paneling. And in the beginning, you don't know why he's doing this, so it could have been something about Kamui's blood. But Hinata was very explicit later that every time he starts to change is when Kamui is getting closer to making his decision.
Yeah, it is so interesting.
Yeah, but it is very visually there. So it's definitely like an observation you can't ignore.
We also had Diamonds for Coat Champagne point out that when the Sunshine 60 building went down, those poor penguins from Tokyo Babylon were probably involved. And that's also like extra significant for Subaru and Seishito. So I wanted to acknowledge that because, oh God.
I'm crying now. Oh, I didn't want to think about that at all. That is too sad.
So cruel, Clamp. Why do you hurt us this way?
Oh, they know we like it.
It's true. We also have a bit more info from Talis, who kind of helped us earlier with some information about the Brazilian translation. And I'm kind of mostly paraphrasing here, but this is basically what they told us. So most of Clamp's works were published in Brazil in 2000 by a company called JBC, Japan Brazil Communication, and they brought a lot of other manga over as well, which is kind of around the era when we in America were getting so many things from Tokyo Pop. Sao Paulo has a big Asian population, including people from Japan, and that city is more culturally diverse than the rest of the country, with immigrants from all over the world. That said, there are not a lot of white people there, but there is this trend of rich folks aligning themselves with white culture. For more on this, they recommend the movie Bacurau, which is spelled B-A-C-U-R-A-U, and I'm sorry that I definitely mispronounced it.
Bacurau, I think.
Bacurau? Okay. Japanese has just, like, ruined my ability to touch any, like, vaguely Latin root language. I just can't do it anymore.
Yeah, no, also, I have that problem where I have many, many years of Spanish, and so I just ruin Portuguese, and I am just so sorry, because Portuguese is kind of one of my favorite languages to listen to, but I just can't get it out of my mouth properly, and it makes me sad.
Anyway, since most media comes out or through Sao Paulo, there's a lot of erasure around the different accents and dialects from the area. So basically, the translators gave Sodata speech patterns that align with the poor parts of Sao Paulo as a form of othering him, and this was most likely translated by someone who was not from these parts of town. They compared it to dialects from Brooklyn and other poorer/blacker boroughs of New York. They said overall, they like how Sodata was translated, and that they think it adds to his happy guy attitude. I thought this was all fascinating, and I hope we didn't mess up the explanation too much, because I do think it was very, very interesting. They also added the way Seishiro's last words were translated also made it really seem like he was about to say, I love you, and he even uses the word dear, which I'm not going to say because I earlier note about pronunciation to refer to Subaru. I am sure every translation has some interesting ways of trying to get around this translation thing. Kind of, we talked about that in that volume, that there's just so many ways that that could be dealt with differently. It's so hard. And so thank you again, Talis. I really appreciate all that information and the wonderful emails we've had.
Yeah.
All right. So moving slightly along, I feel like we could and probably will keep coming back to Subaru and Seishiro. But before we move too much further, some of you pointed out that during our discussions on sociopaths and psychopaths, we kind of missed discussing the distinction between assassins and serial killers. We do jokingly kind of talk about Seishiro being a big old serial killer, but there's definitely a nuance there that we haven't really touched on yet. Functionally, they are very similar. They both kill multiple people. Serial killers are usually self-driven for revenge or perversion, whereas assassins are performing a job. There could definitely be overlap, for instance, serial killers who are assassins, and I think a lot of our thoughts around this have to do with the narrative arc of such characters in fiction, and less with any real-life psychological profiles. To the victims, or the theoretical fictional victims, it's all the same. To the families of the victims, it's down to personal feelings about which is worse. But to the families of the killers, or, you know, the, like, fans and people kind of aligned with that side of the narrative, that's probably a pretty important distinction.
Yeah, I think the reason you get all this really blasé stuff from me about it is that, as I've mentioned before, I have this interest in reframing conversations onto humanizing the victims rather than the perpetrators. So I may have been a little bit of a jerk about this on purpose, but that's partially because I really want to challenge how, I mean, first of all, I kind of challenging seeing assassin as somehow like a thing you're allowed to be, like assassins and soldiers, like thinking about that as being somehow more acceptable. But also, this is all so messy because, like, I don't know, we act like we know why people kill, but it gets really eugenicsy really quick when we talk about things like personality disorders being good science, which they're not, and sociopaths, psychopaths are not scientifically accurate terms that determine whether a human being is a monster or not. So it gets really messy, and it's really hard to talk about this and make it clear when you're talking about, like, tropes in fiction versus reality, especially because a lot of people don't make that distinction, and you don't know whether the person you're talking to does or doesn't. Mm-hmm. In Tokyo Babylon and X, the distinction gets extra blurred, right? Because Seishiro, I mean, like, I think they're blurring it on purpose. He is an assassin. He kills people not only because he's told to by whoever's hiring him, which I think is the government, but also, we're told that he kills people because he doesn't distinguish between people and things, so it doesn't seem like a bad thing to him to do. It's portrayed as though he maybe enjoys it. We are really given the impression that he does. It's interesting, though, because, of course, we know that to get soldiers to kill, you have to dehumanize the enemy. We also find out, because, like, in X, that this is a calling passed down to him by his mother, as though it were a precious family tradition or business, not just murder for hire because he's financially has to or something. So maybe he enjoys it, maybe it's his calling just because it was how he was raised. But the way he talks about Subaru being his prey leaves the realm of professionalism, it kind of leaves that and into something more personal. So I just sort of have this like question of, do we really feel comfortable putting a facade of legitimacy on killing people by using a word like assassin as distinct from other people who murder? I do, though, regret using the term serial killer here to some degree, because I don't want to enter the fray on what that could possibly mean and whether they exist as, like, a class of people or have anything in common other than a description of something someone has done. But I mostly remember using it here to describe the character type that, like, the charming murderer character type that he was embodying.
Yeah, and we don't want to get too much into the realm of reality here, because, oh boy, that could get super dark super fast. But suffice to say, the ambiguity here has been discussed for years about many characters other than Seishiro, and it's definitely worth considering as we think about his character in later iterations and when we inevitably come back to him again and again, possibly without prompting. As we've said before, we're big fans of this character, and we know he was one of Okawa's favorite characters to write. He's a fan favorite both on this podcast and within the fandom itself. As I kind of said earlier, terms like serial killer and assassin are most useful when we're using them to describe different character tropes. You can find plenty of media that ruminates on both, in positive and negative ways, and I think discussing the ways Seishiro does and does not fit into these tropes is a really good way of analyzing his character. He kind of has aspects of both, like you were saying. He doesn't really fit either definition exactly, so maybe he's both or neither. And I think kind of like puzzling the distinction to that is sort of the fun part, or at least one fun part of discussing this character and his various iterations and possible motivations and all of that.
Oh, yeah. No, like, ambiguity is kind of an important part of X, which we will keep bringing up here. Speaking of kind of ambiguity, although here it might have more to do with motivation.
Yeah, so we did say we'd come back around to the really visceral, upsetting stuff with birth in this comic. Both the fail sword births and the Taku's not born of woman stuff.
Honestly, there are hours of unpacking here, probably even more hours than unpacking Seishudo, and I would die in my chair if I had to think about this topic for too long, because I happen to be really squeamish about fatal birth as a theme. It feels too personal and scary for me in a way that does not feel fun. It just makes me feel really dehumanized. So I tried to think about how the swords are supposed to be, like, biologically human, basically. They're Kamui and Fuma's sword brothers slash sisters, right? That doesn't make me feel any better, actually. The mothers are transforming into them almost. My partner Nate says he could kind of see it that way, that they really are sword moms. I don't think that makes me feel better either, to be honest.
It kind of makes me think of, is it Tales of Destiny where they have like sword buddies?
Yes.
Okay.
They definitely have talking swords.
But aren't they talking swords that used to be like warriors or something?
Yeah, yeah. I think that's like their spirit, the spirit of the warrior is in their sword, which is a very like, yeah, samurai culture type thing. Maybe the hardest thing for me to stomach about X is the fact that we see two beautiful women explode into swords. It is so visceral, literally, and doesn't feel completely unsexualized, and that just really gets to me. I don't like sexualized violence at the best of times, but when the imagery is like something phallic killing a woman, I just leave my body. It makes me so upset and uncomfortable.
Yeah, I remember our feelings about the Silent Hill movie that came out when we were in college.
Just hate it. And boy, none of this helped the shreds of my heterosexuality as a kid. I have always wondered if this is stemming from some internalized discomfort with heterosexuality. But we didn't ask them, so it feels really unfair to speculate too much. But, you know, Nataku being special because they're a Franken clone and no one had to give birth to them maybe synergizes with this, as well as mythological stuff kind of combining the Neza legend and other stories like Momotaro, but also maybe even kind of interpretations on the Christ-like virgin birth. I don't know. I don't know, man. Also, back in the day, and I guess still, there's this whole theory of discourse about BL and yaoi and other homoerotic themes in shoujo manga all being about straight female readers and creators' discomfort with heterosexuality slash seeing women as being attacked in sexual situations, and anything where pregnancy or birth has deadly consequences could be seen as supporting that thesis. I know we, Lucy and I, are not very invested in that reading because we're both queer, and don't feel that way. Like, that's definitely not why we read the stuff and what we get out of it.
Yeah.
Also, like, do men get accused of being scared of heterosexuality when they like seeing girls kiss? It feels like someone accusing women of infantilizing themselves, which in turn sounds pretty patronizing and infantilizing to me. Plus, it leaves out queer theory completely and acts as though we understand human arousal and attraction and sexual fantasy material to all be just, like, orbiting around what is ideal for heteronormative reproductive activity, which I think is very reductive. But then you can come back around to the M-Preg stuff and the egg baby JoJo fix, so maybe there is something to be said about how all of these threads can be woven together into a rich, weird tapestry of human sexuality. To put this into further perspective, at least the Madhouse OVA series version of Taito Monogatari, Doomed Megalopolis, has women being forcibly impregnated, you know, raped, to bring about the Kamui, like, chosen one characters, which is drastically less humanizing than women choosing to take on a horrible fate to try to save the world. And that makes me feel a little better.
Yeah, it is all very fraught and uncomfortable, but I do think that the fact that this is media more or less made by women for women does soften all this discomfort for me a little. They're also pulling from a lot of body horror and regular horror, which I am woefully underqualified to talk about. Are there some images here that cross over with misogynistic depictions? Sure. Does it diminish my overall enjoyment of the series? Not really.
It isn't the only potentially uncomfortable thing about the series, though.
Yeah.
There's another one we wanted to talk about.
Yeah, we also wanted to talk about a trend we noticed with the Dream Seers. It seems like the manga is drawing an inverse relationship between mental powers and physical abilities. On one end, we have Kakyo, who is the most powerful Dream Seer and the least mobile. On the other, we have Hokuto, who has very little spiritual abilities, but was able to fully participate in normal life, putting aside the whole dead thing.
Oh man, you're right, too. She was even good at martial arts and stuff.
Yeah. So this gets sticky and kind of uncomfortable if you read them as disabled. There's a problem in media of only having disabled characters when they also have magical powers, or using magical powers to negate their disabilities. I'm not qualified to debate whether or not Clamp does that, certainly not right now, but I think it's okay to move these characters away from that trope, like the anime does when it removes Kotori's illness.
Hinata and Kakyo both have deep and intricate characterizations and love interests, which might be comforting to some disabled readers tired of bullshit, but there's definitely ableism to be read here, like you said, Lucy. So I'd never tell someone not to claim these characters, but I'd also not push it too hard as good representation, basically.
Yeah, like basically it's not necessarily a problem with this specific series. It's a larger problem with media everywhere. If there was more good representation, it wouldn't matter as much to have a few series here and there that lean in the other direction, because they wouldn't be carrying the weight of being the only representation. And I'm not really calling Clamp out for this, but more using as a reminder for folks to think about these things in their own writing and to think critically about them when they see them in media.
I think we could have an awesome discussion with disability activists about this topic later in our podcast, and I look forward to staking out some time to do that more justice with a drastically more qualified co-host, which we know some of, so we can definitely do that.
Yeah, yeah, I would love to revisit this, especially as we get, like, further into more Clamp works to kind of see how this develops as well, just as a thing that they may or may not use again.
Yeah. Well, I think we're ready to just dive right into symbolism now. Ooh. We're just gonna jump down this rabbit hole, Lucy.
Mm-hmm.
So, we'll start with something fairly straightforward that we just kept putting off. Drag me down the rabbit hole, Lucy. Tell me about tarot cards.
Okay, it's time for my short essay on tarot cards.
Lucy is our tarot correspondent here.
I am, coming to you from the Tarot Cards HQ. As we've observed, each volume of X begins with a tarot card with an image of one of the characters paired with a Hebrew letter. Until researching this, I didn't quite realize how linked modern tarot decks are with Kabbalah mysticism, especially the kind of pop culture Kabbalah we've talked about in the past.
So some quick history. Actually, Lucy's going to do most of it, which is why it's going to be quick at all, because you know what happens if I start to talk about history. Tarot cards originated around the 14th century, simple playing cards used for a different set of games than the 52-card deck that most Americans are familiar with, which are actually called trumps. Even today, these kinds of decks have a lot in common, and card decks other than trumps are widely used all over the world. Think Hanafuda cards, like what Nintendo made before video games.
Yeah, it wasn't until the 18th century that tarot cards took on a mystical significance, and this was helped along by the Victorians' fascination with occultism and spiritualism just in general. Perhaps the most famous deck is the Rider-Waite deck, which is sometimes called the Waite-Smith deck to give credit to the artist, which was published in 1909. Most modern tarot decks are based on this deck, and the Rider part, by the way, comes from the publisher, like the person who wanted to make it was Waite, and then Smith was the artist, and Rider was the publisher. I just went down that rabbit hole on my own, so come with me!
I think that's cool.
So tarot has two types of cards, called Major and Minor Arcana. The Minor Arcana are composed of number cards and court cards in four suits that are usually wands, pentacles, cups, and swords, although there can be some variation between decks. The Major Arcana consists of 22 cards depicting different symbols. This is where we get cards like the Fool, the Earth, and Death. They are the cards Clamp's used in X, and I believe also the cards used in JoJo's Stardust Crusaders arc for stand names?
Sure are.
So until the Rider-Waite deck, the Major Arcana were the only cards with elaborate pictorial designs. Before that, the Minor Arcana cards just depicted their suit and number, kind of like our trump cards now.
Yeah.
So the Five of Wands was just an image of five wands. However, Rider-Waite and any decks based on it incorporate more symbolism into the design of these cards. So the Five of Wands might show a group of people dancing or battling with the wands, which opens things up for interpretation, right? And therefore provided more visual symbolism to interpret in divination. Despite this fact, the Major Arcana are still frequently used alone in divination, and since they're the ones Clamp used, they're the ones we're going to focus on. Okay, so tarot started as playing cards, but people began to connect the tarot and Kabbalah around the 1800s when the cards took on a mystic significance. This was mostly by way of the Order of the Golden Dawn. Now, we don't have time to get into the Order of the Golden Dawn, but basically, it was founded by a few members of the Freemasons in the late 1800s, including Aleister Crowley, in its ranks, and inspired a lot of modern paganism, especially Wicca and other traditions drawing from the UK.
Also, the Kabbalah they were interested in was Hermetic Kabbalah, which is the less Jewish and sometimes overtly anti-Semitic stuff. So again, we're not going to get into the Golden Dawn too much. Maybe we will at some point. I don't know that we're ever going to have to do that in the Clamp podcast. I do want to point out that we're not great, and as influential on so much counterculture as they are, it also explains some of the abuse and racism and other bullshit that's worked into a lot of it, which sucks. Though, unlike the Freemasons, they did allow women into the Order of the Golden Dawn, so I guess there's one thing they have going for them. But back on track, Lucy, I'm so sorry.
Oh, no, you're fine. I was actually wondering where the Hermetic stuff came up because I didn't That's quite like Hermes.
Yeah.
Anyway, there are 22 letters in the Hebrew alphabet and 22 major arcana cards in a tarot deck, so perhaps it was natural that spiritualists of the time would have connected the two. They are more or less structured in alphabetical order for the Hebrew letters and numbered order for the cards, with some variation. This added a new level of symbolism to the cards, using the Hebrew letters to symbolize a specific path to enlightenment aligned with the attached card. Divinists also draw on aspects of Kabbalah for specific spreads, that is, ways of arranging and reading the cards during a divination. For instance, there is a Tree of Life spread based on the Sephirot. Interestingly, the Hebrew letters do not appear on the Rider-Waite deck, and is, in my very uneducated opinion, I think this might explain some of the variation in orders that we and Alan, who helped us research this a bit, were kind of finding some variation in, like, the way the Hebrew letters were in some of the cards, and I think this just comes down to people drawing symbolism from different decks for, you know, for this, the kind of deck that we have, that Clamp is using. So all that is to say, Clamp's cards follow the Rider-Waite order, and from what I can tell, these cards also follow the Hebrew alphabet. They begin with the first card, the Magician, instead of the zero card, the Fool. This is really only notable because some traditions consider the Major Arcana as the Fool's journey through life, but it's pretty common to have the Fool shift between the end or beginning of the deck, depending on which version you're pulling from, or which game you're playing, depending on where you're getting these cards from. So, of the 22 cards, 18 have been published in the collected volumes of X, and one, The Fool, in the art book X0. So we're only missing 3 cards, and theoretically 3 volumes of X. So here's what we have so far. Number 1.
This is so exciting.
Oh, good. I'm glad you're ready.
No, I'm so ready for this. Give it to me.
Number 1, The Magician, which is one of the Kamuis, I'm assuming actual Kamui, because it's the first one we see. And this is the Hebrew letter Bet. It's thought to bridge the gap between heaven and earth, usually embodies all the elements, and is associated with the planet Mercury and Gemini and or Virgo in astrology.
The Gemini part sure seems on the nose, huh?
I know, right? So number 2, the High Priestess, Hinoto, and the letter Gimel, which is associated with wisdom, secrets, mystery, and the cloaked future.
Oh my god.
Number 3, the Empress Kanoe with the letter Dalet. And this card holds power over life, the year, and growing things. It's tied to the natural world, fertility, the truth of the heart, and the violence of nature. It's very earth goddess and also tied to the High Priestess.
Oh my god.
Right?
That's like, yeah, it's a little weird how that almost has more development for Kanoe than she actually gets in the series, which is both tragic but interesting.
Mm-hmm. So number 4, the Emperor, is Mr. Mono Kotori Infuma's father.
I think his name is Kyogo.
Kyogo? Yeah, I think.
Yeah, he's Kyogo Mono. Yeah.
And it's the letter He. It's associated with power, wisdom, and ultimate strength / ruling power. Which seems very father figure, like it kind of makes sense. Number 5, the Hierophant, Aoki, which is the letter Wao. I might be saying that very wrong, I apologize. It's a bridge between heaven and earth, between gods and humans, a teacher and a guide who welcomes you to study.
Oh.
I know. So number 6, the Lovers, which is Kotori with Kamui behind her, and it's the letter Zion. It's associated with relationships and choices, temptation or sacrifice of one's former life. It's also tied to twin imagery and lost innocence, Adam and Eve, and the lasting ramifications of our choices.
Ugh, that's nuts.
Mm-hmm.
By the way, Het. It is Het. Sorata,
really?
The letter.
Okay, the thing I found said Chet, but I don't know.
Well, remember Hanukkah is spelled with a C,
Oh, it's true. Okay, I see. So number 7, the Chariot, is Sorata, and it's the letter Het. It's associated with war, triumph, vengeance, and a hero returned. the great responsibility that rests on a champion's shoulders.
Mm-hmm.
Number 8, strength, is Yuzuriha and the Lairtet. It's associated with enlightenment, harmony, and having overcome earthly cravings or animal passions through refinement and maturity.
I love that the youngest member gets that one.
Yes.
Like, that is really interesting.
Mm-hmm, it is really good. I think that one is actually, like, traditionally a woman, too, not, like, it because I assumed it would kind of, the word strength seemed like it would be traditionally, like, a big dude or something, but I think it is actually traditionally a woman, or, like, a...
That is really neat.
Maybe more, a more feminine figure. All right, number 9, the Hermit, is Satsuki, and the letter Yod. It's associated with the search for enlightenment, but also treason and corruption. It's got evolution and the long journey to wisdom in there. And also on this one, the Hebrew letter was written differently in the Japanese version of the manga than the Viz Omnibus. And this threw me off for a while. Going by the order of the alphabet, I'm pretty sure it's supposed to be Yod, but the US printing doesn't look anything like any depiction of that letter I could find. Like, it is a wildly different letter. It may be a variant, but I have no idea why they changed it, and I couldn't find, like, anything that told me there was a typical variant of Yod at all, and let alone that looked anything like this, so I don't know.
Yeah, and remember how, like, messed up I got in trying to describe these, where just, like, the whatever font they used for that script is a little weird anyway, so I had a really hard time reading it.
Yeah, but this one, like no, Yod is just, like, a tiny little thing, and then the one that is printed in my book is, like, a much, like, larger, different shape. Like, it, some of them I could kind of see, oh, different calligraphy, but this looks wildly different, so I don't know. I'm sure there's a reason. So number 10 is the Wheel of Fortune, and that's Kakyo with the letter Kaf. It's associated with destiny, fortune, and change.
I mean, that one felt, like, very predictable in a good way. Like, satisfyingly predictable. You're like, yes, of course Kakyo is the Wheel of Fortune. Like, of course.
Yeah.
Some of the others, I feel like there's, like, it's revelatory, and that one you're just like, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, I'm like, naturally, moving on. Yeah. So number 11 is Justice and Kaden, and it's the letter Lamed. It's associated with equity, balance, law, goodness, empathy, and karma.
Wow.
Yeah. Number 12 is the Hanged Man, which is Subaru, and the letter Mem. It's associated with self-sacrifice, wisdom, the search for knowledge, arrested development, and a time of reflection.
That one, the very little that I ever knew about tarot was enough for me to see how significant Subaru is the Hanged Man and the next card were. Like, at least I knew enough to think that was profound.
Yeah, so. They're good. So number 13 is Death, Seishiro, the letter Nun. It's associated with significant changes, rebirth, the end of something, freedom to move forward, and punishment of sin. And I have to go on a sidebar here, because any movie or whatever that uses this card to signify the death of a character is missing the damn point, and I'm sorry, I'm really tired of seeing this in, like, popular culture. Stop doing it! It's change, damn it, change!
Yeah, no, and I think that's so incredible that Seishiro is embodying this concept of change, especially because he significantly kind of can't change.
Yeah,
it's interesting. Really, really interesting.
Mm-hmm. All right, so 14 is Temperance, and it's Arashi, and the letter Samek. It's associated with the attainment of a goal, moderation, frugality, cleansing, and growth through hardship. And number 15, the Devil, is Yuto, Ayin, and this is one of the, I think, letters that is silent frequently in Hebrew. I don't know exactly how that works, but that's what the internet told me. It's associated with violence, effort, force, predestination, taboo, inner natural darkness, and freedom from societal pressure.
That is really interesting.
Right? And number 16, the Tower, is Tokiko and Toru, and the letter Pe. It's associated with sudden change, disruption, revelation, destablement of society, revolution, the bringing down of the powerful class. And I got big Utena vibes from this one.
Yeah, which really, I love that. I really also, I mean, Tokiko, sorry that you're getting roped into this, but I really love revolutionary lesbians as a theme. Mm-hmm, so, mm-hmm. You know, it's the best.
We don't know that she's not a revolutionary lesbian. It's fine.
Oh, yeah, no, I just feel like with Toru, we, like, literally know, and with Tokiko, it's like, I don't know. Sorry to assume.
Yeah. So number 17 is the Star, with Kusanagi, and it's Sade, the letter Sade, associated with loss, hope, the freedom to be yourself, reconnection, and position within the universe.
Wow.
And then number 18 is the Moon, which is Nataku and the letter Kof. It's associated with inner nature, calm, danger, deception, innocence, and insight. And it's the connection of the soul.
Wow. Yeah. Beautiful for a character that is being told they don't have a soul, right?
Yeah. And the number zero, which is the one that appeared in the art book, is the fool, Saya. She's kind of like depicted as sort of like a mermaid. It's very cool looking. And it's the letter Aleph, which is another one of the silent letters. And it's associated with vulnerability, innocence, carnal urges, the beginning of the journey to wisdom. And in some readings, all the major arcanas are interpreted around the fool's journey, like I mentioned before. But I don't know that that really lines up with Saya all that much, but I kind of wanted to mention it.
I think it's really interesting to imagine how she might be.
Yeah, right? Like, I mean, in many ways, she kind of started everything. Like, it wasn't her choice, necessarily. Like, she did not this
we'll
whole thing happen.
Yeah. We'll get to that.
All right, so...
Which ones are we missing, Lucy?
We are missing three cards. They are number 19, the sun, which with the letter that would, in theory, line up with it would be sin. It's associated with knowledge, renewal, happiness, contentment, and goodness. And the card number 20, judgment, with the letter shin. It's associated with judgment, rebirth, second chances, resurrection, reunion. That's another one of those that's not too surprising. Number 21, the world, ta, the letter ta. It's associated with change, success, voyage, inner knowledge, and freedom. And those are all of the cards. So it's hard to know which characters might go with those missing three cards, since it could kind of be anyone, because we've got, you know, like Mr. Monol in there. Like, it doesn't have to be just the dragons and everything. But the only dragon we're missing is Dark Kamui, or Fuma, unless the magician Kamui counts for both of them, which, I mean, it very well might. So it's sort of like, we don't have like a list of characters those have to be because there are only so many characters left. But I would personally love to see Saiki or Hokuto in those cards. Can you think of anyone you'd like to see or kind of expect to see?
Yeah, my brain really thinks the sun would be either Saiki or Hokuto, even though Hokuto is the North Star. But I think the world card could just be the planet Earth, since the tower was Tokyo Tower.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I would definitely expect that.
Yeah. I really think Judgment is going to be Dark Kamui / Fuma. I really think it's going to be. Like, I'm not going to, like, put money on it, but I just really feel like that is what that would be.
Yeah. Yeah. That would make a lot of sense.
Yeah. Keiichi could be a card, but maybe not. Poor guy. Maybe he doesn't deserve this bullshit.
Yeah, I could see him maybe being the son of the world, since he kind of represents this thing that Kamui's fighting for.
It'd be really cool if he were the world card, right? Yeah. That'd be beautiful.
Yeah.
So I know you said something to me when you did this research about, like, did they start here when creating the characters? And I think you are onto something.
Yeah, this, like, completely broke me. I don't have textual proof of them saying this in an interview or anything, but I am like 90%, if not more, convinced that they started with the tarot cards and worked backwards to form characters. At the very least, I think the aspects of the different cards heavily influenced their development of the characters. Like, even if they came up with the characters and the plot first, they like went back and drastically like mapped them on these tarot cards because they match up so well. And I would really recommend people track down, like, the tarot card images and then compare them to a book or website that walks you through the Rider-Waite tarot deck, because the meanings and imagery associated with the cards are just so beautifully, meticulously recreated in ways that both fits the cards and fits the characters. And, oh, that's just so gorgeous. Oh, and I do also want to add, there are many, like, Clamp tarot decks that kind of include these last three cards, but not all of them include, like, all of the same cards leading up, so I couldn't really count any of them as, like, the canon way that we know these cards would go, because they've produced lots of just tarot card art for fun and to sell and stuff, so there may be versions of these cards that are true, but we don't know for sure until they're actually in the published works, which is why I didn't kind of go into that at all.
Yeah. I mean, in general, you could say this era of their creation especially has this high degree of structural element controlling metaphor symbolism stuff that drives things rather than just being super grounded in social realism and stuff.
Yeah.
Which I think synergizes nicely. Boy, I'm going to say synergize way too many times. That is not a word you should use, but I'm going to use it like 10 times a day. I'm so sorry. It does, however, synergize nicely with the discussion of symbolism and visual language that I'm really excited to have. One thing I've gotten more comfortable with as we've worked on this podcast is discussing things from a comic creator's point of view, not just a literary critic's. I mean, we do that too, and we even just express our fanish adoration, which is valid as well. But we both have some insight into how comics and fiction in general are created, what tools artists have at their disposal, etc. It's also super weird to talk about visuals without visuals, so bear with me. But X is a visual feast, and so much of its strength and power comes from how it looks and how they made it look that way, both their increasing mastery of technique and tools, but also their visual storytelling. X is really full of scenes that we described as though you would just see talking or yelling heads, but in fact they were sweeping epic images full of symbols and motifs and characters and metaphorical poses, and that we could just tell you what happens in a comic by trying to distill the dialogue and also interpret what these images are meant to make you think and feel, it will only ever be our subjective approximation. But at least we're trying, because it is a huge percentage of what is delivering meaning, not just some cool-looking stuff to take up space on the page.
Yeah, it has been really fun and rewarding to get better at trying to convey these images without adding too much of our own interpretations, like, at the same time. But yeah, nothing can really compare to the visuals themselves.
Yeah. So, one thing to think about here, because, like, I know I'm going to talk about symbolism, which is just brings people to the, oh, this means something else. I'm like, that gets a little convoluted in comics. In visual media, sometimes the imagery on the page is literal. It's the action we're supposed to follow sequentially, right? Mm-hmm. But you also have this wonderful power of showing imagery that isn't precisely the literal action happening. This is great, because often, as I just alluded to, the literal action is characters sitting around talking, which gets boring and repetitive to draw or look at for pages and pages. One of the hurdles every comic artist has to jump over is the talking heads problem. Not someone burning down the house or a psycho killer asking you what's up, but the thing I just described, is it okay to have a talking heads joke here? I probably should have made it a JoJo reference instead, but I just went for it. Keeping things visually interesting is one concern, but another consideration for artists is how to tell a story beyond the literal. How do you introduce and reinforce less tangible themes in a way that is memorable and effective? You use motifs and icons and symbols and stuff. They can be visual metaphors, elements that repeat so they help you connect things, icons that are a visual representation of what's being discussed. For example, a lot of the time in X, when characters ramble about the dragons of Earth or Heaven, we see a seal with dragons on it, or see the dragons themselves rising from the Earth or coming down from the heavens. Whether or not this will ever happen, it is so clear visually that you'll associate the two sides with these more metaphysical, mythological aspects, not just characters in school uniforms and suits. It's iconography more than like a metaphor or anything. These dragons are one and the same, or they represent the same thing, even if they're not literally there when Hinoto mentions them. So like seeing a visual representation of the Big Dipper and dragons curling around it just helps remind us that we're connecting cosmic mythological elements with this prognosticated doom. So like not all visual elements are specifically for action or meaning. You do have non-literal compositional elements meant to help direct the eye, give emphasis to something like a frame behind a character's head or show movement like flowers blowing across the page. This is also a really important part of visual storytelling, but less relevant to the discussion of symbolism, except for the fact that I think they also use their motifs this way. So there are things I may have hoped were symbolic that were more just for emphasis. Yeah. Now in X, everything is even more complicated by the fact that sometimes characters literally see visions or dreams of the future, where the imagery is symbolic but literally happening in the dream. Mm. So they're actually seeing hooded figures grow wings and hold glass earths, even if those things are technically happening in real life. They are happening on the page, and the symbols and imagery that end up on the pages of X are sometimes an actual callback to these visions, things we've seen in visions but dreams and stuff, but sometimes it's something else altogether. So this is where we get these visual motifs that seem to symbolize something, since they are repeated but don't come from a specific literal element in the story. Perhaps they come from thematic elements that don't have an obvious physical representation. So I literally made a spreadsheet. It is a very bad spreadsheet. I could show it to people. You will hate it. Everything is misspelled because I typed one-handed while holding the book with the other hand. It's a mess. But I did keep track of every time Gears and Clockwork show up, Cherry Blossoms, Feathers, and then two more, which I kind of regret, which were Ripples and Celestial Rings, or what I called Celestial Rings. In doing this, I found some cool insights, but I also ran into a discovery, which is that Feathers show up so often, I couldn't find enough commonalities between them. So I came to the conclusion they're more of a visual element to help transition in and out of visions or the past, or just to cue the reader to the fact there's something especially relevant to the end of the world, and especially Kotori's visions about it being brought up on the page. We're talking like 200 times, not counting each page of a sequence. Oh, I just got totally overwhelmed.
I'm overwhelmed knowing you did this. Also very grateful.
Yeah, it didn't come to that much, but I did it, so we're talking about it. It did make me think about how much the feathers and other visual elements help us understand which level of reality we're in X. Is it actually happening? Is it a vision? A memory within a vision? A dream of the past? So much of X is action happening in these metaphysical and nonlinear spaces, and it's only occasionally confusing, which is a testament to how well they used this stuff. Most straightforward of all the things I could interpret from this data I collected were the cherry blossoms. I went into this assuming they were basically a leitmotif for Seishudo, maybe the bond he and Subaru share, but I think they actually represent promises, or the bonds created by a promise. For example, the first time you see them is when we're getting to know that Kamui Fuma and Kotori have a bond. Yeah, it's also like April and there are literally cherry blossoms, but they only show up when we're getting a hint that these people are connected. And when we finally see the scenes where they made childhood pinky promises with each other, the cherry blossoms are prominent.
That's amazing!
Yeah, you never see them when there isn't a discussion of a promise going on, by the way. So we definitely see them whenever Seishudo and Subaru's bond through their bet, which is a kind of promise, right, is brought up too. But we also see them when Toru and Saya make a promise. We see them when Arashi's priestess caretaker tells her that someday someone will love her so much, and callbacks to that when she's thinking about it, hanging out with Sorata very near the end. Even when Kamui and Yuzuriha pinky promise that he'll ask her for help. I tracked 54 instances, and they all correlated to one of these bonds or promises.
Ah, I've got, like, goosebumps. That's so cool.
Yeah, that is really cool. Like, that is definitely them having this motif that shows up and kind of keeps harkening back to this one really interesting theme and concept. So, okay. The next one I'm pretty sure I'm right about are the gears. Though you'll have to forgive me for being unscientific here, because I went in with an assumption, though it was a pretty educated one. When the gears show up in the background, I always thought of them as being like a tick-tock reminding us that time was marching on and there's a mechanistic deterministic interpretation of the future in play here. And I think my data supports that. Not that this isn't an ever-present theme in X, but I think that this is one way they reinforce that theme. We first saw it when Kotori had her glass earth dream slash vision. We saw it repeated in that section when Kamui drops the glass earth. It shows up in beats that get you closer to one future or the other, or when characters discuss those moments, especially when characters repeat that there is only one future, or, I mean, only two futures and only one can happen, right? Towards the end, when Kakyo and Hinata lament that they want to believe there's hope for an undecided future despite how they believe their visions prognosticate a fixed deterministic fate, the gears show up big time. But there's also this amazing moment when Hinata kind of first breaks away from asserting that there's just these two futures and she knows which one will happen. When she asks Saiki if he regrets or resents the path he's on, maybe implying that she does or thinks he should since it's so unfair to him because he's about to die, there is a broken clock with gears springing out behind her. Oh. Almost like she's breaking character here.
Ooh.
So cool.
Yeah.
So, the problem with the other two things I tracked. First of all, the problem is that I didn't track beads, but I will talk to you about beads really briefly at the end of this because they use them really carefully and they use them the same way, but like they show up like 8 times or whatever, so it just wasn't as rich of a thing to track. And I certainly didn't have any confusion about what beads mean in this. Here's the problem. I can't tell whether the other two things are more compositional elements or symbolic, and my head exploded, so there's a chance that they are three things and not two things. We'll get there. I'm calling something a celestial ring. They have kind of a sacred geometry look. I think they may be elements pulled out from the divination board slash star chart behind Hinata.
Okay.
Which is kind of a feng shui magic thing too. They are especially associated with the Dragon of Earth Kamui and the twin star two sacred sword stuff. They show up a lot in the early part of the story where you're starting to get hints about that. Connecting, talking about two swords and two Kamuis, they kind of stop showing up at a certain point, and pretty much like once that's all firmly established, we don't see them very often ever again. In fact, we see rings breaking behind Fuma's head when he almost says, "I'm your twin star," to Kamui before he fully turned. The rings and ripples, like there are these ripples that are sometimes rings, but they're kind of like either concentric or like overlapping, but they don't have these extra little curly cues and stuff that are why I determined something is a celestial ring rather than a ripple. Other people have, I think, written about some of this stuff too, so you can probably find really good interpretations other than mine. I'm just giving you what I have, okay? Mm-hmm. But these, I think, are always just harkening back to remembering Hinoto and Kotori's dreams, because they have these watery dream spaces, and actual ripples only show up in Hinoto, Kotori, and Kakyo's dream spaces, and they're largely just to, like, show what the space is. Mm. I think they're mostly just describing the environment or showing movement through those dreams, and maybe they become something we associate with dreams in those three dream seers. I'm pretty sure half the things I tracked as ripples were more like rings that are a compositional element to give emphasis to a character or piece of text, like a frame, since visual hierarchy gets confusing when you have so much going on a page. There is a chance that the rings, celestial rings, and gears give a clue as to the ending. That is, if you connect these things, you can see which characters' slightly contradictory views or cryptic prophecies are correct. But since there is no ending, I can't tell. Hmm. There's data missing, and that makes it hard to interpret. Mm-hmm. But I tried. I tried with the feathers. So many feathers. There are also beads, which we first saw in Tokyo Babylon. We saw that they are the beads that Hokuto was wearing on, like, the prayer necklaces, and they break. Like, those strands of beads are broken when she dies, and they do that where frequently we see Kotori with beads in her hair as a background element, and then we see strings of beads flying all over the place when we talk about Kotori's death and Hokuto's death. So that feels, like, pretty straightforward, right? So much of the power of X is how it takes a violent epic battle and makes it all about characters' inner worlds, their thoughts and feelings and motivations. And all of this imagery really helps make those inner worlds visible on the page and have the same importance as a cool fight scene or the city falling down. Your inner world may be as real or more real to you than the real world outside, after all. There are a couple other repeated visuals I didn't keep track of other than beads, such as the dual-winged Kamui images. We often mentioned when a vision showed Kamui with one feathered wing, one bat-like wing. It's repeated often, and with some variations, but it's always when the discussion touches on Kamui's duality, his two futures or choices or his twin star, and helps reinforce the theme of duality and gives us something to track. Feather wings versus bat wings, which belong to which Kamui? Hmm. I also slightly regret not tracking the glass earth shards of glass shattering imagery better, but to be honest, that one also feels really straightforward to me. After the first time we see Kamui dropping a glass earth which shatters in Kotori's dream, the shattering glass that frames so many pages is there when we're discussing the earth being destroyed or things that would lead to that future. Mm. It harkens back to Kotori's desire to break instead of the earth, and I think it shows the character's own hearts breaking being analogous to the whole world breaking. How fragile and artificial both are.
Wow, yeah. I think part of me definitely associated the breaking imagery with, like, Kotori's dreams, but not in any sort of scientific way. So if we were going to put symbolism to bed a bit eventually, we should actually address Christianity.
We have mentioned this is very influenced by the end of days stuff from the Book of Revelation, so we don't need to go over that forever. But everything from Tokyo as a Babylon that is falling to the seals and angels are all directly from that. They even have a few lines about the horns are sounded, which is what happens when the angels remove the seals from the scrolls and calamities unfurl.
Yeah, but we kind of glossed over how clearly Kamui is a Christ figure. I think we covered that so much in, like, high school English classes with every other book we read that we just, like, felt like it went without saying. But it is seen through a non-Western lens, and that's really interesting.
Yeah, in the West, we kind of can't not look at any Chosen One narrative as being a reference to Jesus Christ. But Kamui is literally dying for humanity's sins in the anime. And in imagery, and in the text, he's crucified frequently, more literally by his best friend rather than just being sold out by him. So it's pretty clearly a Christ figure down to his name. And maybe Subaru is too, with scars on his hands, or maybe he's Judas, who knows?
It is also neat how the only Christian character in the manga, Kaden, also kind of embodies the Madonna-whore duality, but I think in a way that is less groan-worthy than it could have been. So it's full of biblical references, but it's also really connected to another great book, their own professional debut! And I'm sorry for this transition that Robin wrote, by the way, but there was really no way to make this work.
Okay, so I'm so sorry. Readers who started with Rigveda would see so many themes paralleled so directly, as it is almost another take on similar material, down to a prophecy and large numbers of heroes to collect. Lucy, I know you can expand on this.
Yes. And to prep for this, I re-listened to our Reg Veda episodes, and we did way more like stargazing penalties in like those two episodes than I think in any other, certainly in any other two episodes, partially because we kept thinking about X.
Yes.
And oh man, those episodes. Our podcast was so new. That was literally like our first real episode and second real episode, and then the OVAs. So maybe like first three episodes. We had an episode zero that was before that, but oh, it was so new, and we were so sure we could get through one series per episode. I don't know why. I'm pretty sure we had to record the summary episode twice. It used to be so much longer and worse than it ended up being, which is still kind of bad and long. But anyway.
Thank you for bearing with us, everybody. My goodness. Yeah. Like, really, really appreciate it.
We were trying. We had a rough start. We just had to, you have to kind of just start sometimes. Like, I think yes. We even recorded the intro episode a few times because it took us a while to feel like we were doing anything. So.
Oh, yeah. Like, I couldn't stop just rambling about Hagiyamoto. Like, I couldn't stop myself. So we had to just start scripting things more. And now we script things very heavily, which doesn't stop us from rambling, but it does curtail it a little bit. Okay. Parallels with Rig Veda, Lucy. Go.
Yes. So, prophecies are obviously a big one. In Rig Veda, Yasha knows from the beginning that Ashura may lead to his death, and yet he continues to help them. There are parallels here with Kamui's choice and his continual desire to save Fuma, despite also having to defeat Fuma/Dark Kamui. And also, Rig Veda had the six stars that will split the heavens, and X has the seven dragons times two. So there's a lot there. Also, yeah. Strong stoic dudes. Robin, I know this is not necessarily a new thing, but is it the story of Clan just the story is who is the Jotaro and who is the Kakyoin?
Yes. Yes.
I'm going to talk more about that when we get to something else.
Oh, yeah. This year will be a big year of talking about that.
Yep. So, Fuma and Yasha are big stoic men, a few words, medium-large clan punks.
Nate really did deploy Fuma-class Yaoi barge once, and I begged him to classify other clampman sizes as ships, but he demurred. Please beg him, everybody. Make him do it. He's very good at this, and I want it. I want it on this podcast.
Yes, one day maybe we will have Yaoi barge correspondent Nate on the line. Yes. So, another image that comes up in both is moms. In X, all the moms die, including Tokiko. She's not technically a mom, although I believe one of our friends called her Momui in the anime watch because she looks like Kamui.
So that was really good.
That's just all I think of. She also looks a lot like Yasha, which I mentioned at the time, but anyway.
She just has the claw bangs,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, it's great. And in Rig Veda, of course, we still have Ashura's mom, but she sucks?
Yeah, so she doesn't count.
Yeah. And then, of course, hey, look, there are two swords. In X, it's two of the same sword. Okay. And in Rig Veda, it's mainly just that both Ashura and Yasha have magic swords. It's not really that significant. It's just kind of a parallel. I think it's more parallel from, like, video games, too, but whatever. Ashura's sword is, however, sealed, and the room on Clamp Campus where Kamui seals his sword also reminded us of Rig Veda, so there you go.
Yeah.
And obviously, duality is a big one. In Rig Veda, we had the two sides of Ashura, which I'd slightly forgotten about until I was, like, looking at it again. We have Kid Ashura, who gets progressively older, and, like, Dark Ashura, who the manga actually calls Dark Ashura. And then, obviously, we use this language subconsciously or not. I honestly don't remember. I think I'm the one who started doing it. I don't remember if it was intentional. It may have been.
Yeah, it just felt right.
It just felt right. So we have Dark Kamui and then Dark Hinoto. And some of that is really just created by us because we use that language. But the angle is still there.
Oh, it's definitely there.
And there's also, like, Ashura versus their twin brother, Tennō. It's not really a versus thing, but it's like a parallel or whatever.
Yeah, yeah.
And then Kamui versus Dark Kamui or Fuma and the two Hinotos. If there aren't twins, is it really Clamp at all?
Is it really Clamp at all without twins?
So there is just so much we could talk about, but we only have so much time here. And honestly, I kind of want to reread Rig Veda before we would do that. So at some point we want to revisit Rig Veda and give it more time, but I don't know what form that will take. So don't quote me on it.
More importantly, we're going to put X to bed.
Mm-hmm.
We got to talk about the end.
Yep.
X has 4 iterations, maybe 5 if we count that video game, 3 endings, maybe 4 if we count that video game, and of course, it is the original comic, which is lacking that closure. So we suffer. We know that despite rumors of it being their publishers getting cold feet about the ending being too violent or controversial, officially they have said that they intend to finish it, but needed to put it down in light of various crimes and disasters that changed their taste for the portrayal of kids and violence. 1993 and 2003 felt like very different times.
Sure.
The X movie ends with basically everyone dying but Conley, who, like Satan at the end of Devilman, is left cradling his best friend slash maybe lover's remains. The X anime ends with Conley sacrificing himself so that almost everyone, but especially the Earth, can survive. The fourth iteration, we'll get into it in a couple of years, and rehash this whole conversation, most likely, but you can forget about it for now, because that's Tsubasa we're talking about. Because the X comic leaves off in a place where neither the movie nor the anime's endings could fit perfectly, it seems to beg a third ending, and since we know Clamp do not believe in fate, we can even imagine it might not end with either future prognosticated by Hinato.
Hmm.
Those two futures, remember, are the Earth racked with desertification from environmental collapse caused by humans who lived on long enough to despoil the planet, or the flooded Tokyo, where the dragons of Earth destroy all humanity and anything man-made, and the Earth thrives, supposedly. We also know that Hinato saw a future where Arkamui killed her, releasing her from her tormented life, and also that she saw this future was unlikely to come to pass. We don't know which of those two that adds up to, though, although we have hints. From that glimpse of Volume 19 we have, the world sure looks like flooded Tokyo, though humanity and society have not been utterly destroyed yet. Could that be implying that the glimpses of the future our dream seers have are misleading or incomplete?
Mm.
That there really is a third option? Or that the Dragon of Earth future really is inevitable, as Kakyo, Hinato, and Konoe often implied it was. Interesting to note, it is also heavily implied that when Kakyo asked Kamui which future was more beautiful to him, he thought the flooded one was, but he couldn't choose it because he wanted to protect the people he loved. Is this his true wish? Does that add up? Can we have both? I mean, in real life, we can, but does this narrative lead us to that? The anime seemed to imply to me that he had his cake and ate it too. He could sacrifice himself and protect both the Earth and humanity. I know it's hard for me to not think they're foreshadowing Kamui sacrificing himself for the world like in the anime here. But what else can the ending be? A lot of X's big questions and answers have to do with the importance of choice. They also have some very specific but still slightly ambiguous theses having to do with people's hearts' desires. The cliffhanger leaves us begging to know what Fuma's wish could be, and what of Kamui's true wish. To help support our upcoming conjecture, I wanted to bring up a couple of what I think are key moments in X, both the big answers and questions that leave us with maybe not a roadmap or a star chart, but with some kind of picture of what X amounts to. In the past, right before Saya exploded into a sword, Toru lamented not being strong enough to change Saya's fate, but Saya replies that not even God could do that, because it was a choice Saya herself made. An interesting viewpoint of what strength and power can't do. She couldn't make Saya change what she wanted inside. A question I had, did Saya fuck with destiny by giving birth to the sword instead of Toru?
Mm.
Giving Kamui more time with his mother's love, shaping him into a person who could have human connections? Rig Veda has aspects of, like, being punished for straying from destiny, that is, going against the role you have in society or sinning against cultural mores, including defying a prophecy's version of fate. But they can still do that. When Saya says she's sinful, it made me think of that.
Hmm, yeah.
In Volume 18, Fuma says that dying for the one you love is a choice, but some people desire something else more. Kaden assumes he wants something else, that it is not his wish to die for the one he loves. From conversations with other dragons of Earth, we did hear Fuma expressing that he could understand wanting to be the one who kills the one he loves, as some sort of intimate act of saving them from a worse fate, or just as a possessive form of connection, I'm not quite sure. Certainly a lot of what he says is filtered through this lens of death and killing, as so many of our heroes also seem to see the world in those terms, perhaps because they've been programmed that way. Are we leading to the idea that you should live and not die for someone? That you can desire life and growth and change, not just death for change? Like how the Death Tarot card literally means change. Can we associate it with life instead?
Hmm.
Hinata mostly cares about Kamui's choice, the only one she thinks matters, but when he's finally made his, she explains it in this way that I think defies her fatalistic laments a little bit. She tells him it was wanting to protect those he cared about that made the choice, and, I quote, "it is in such choices that we make our destinies, determine our fates." By the way, in that scene, he has not one of each wing, but full sets of both, as though visually saying he has always carried the full burden of both possibilities slash choices.
Mm.
She explicitly explains that his choice was go out alone and leave the Monos for good, or protect them with his life. His choice was love. Only when we love can we choose to protect. If he had severed with them, he'd have nothing left to protect, making him a dragon of Earth who has no connection to the side of Earth that has humanity. He'd drop the ball, the glass Earth, and let it break. Does this match up with the save humans, kill the planet, or save planet, kill humans aspect? But as Lucy keeps coming back to, there's this other side of wishes and choices, that is, how they affect other people. We know that Subaru was obsessive, unable to desire something other than what he knew would hurt him and other people who cared about him, his own death at Seishido's hands. Nataku, however, actually sacrificed themselves for Kanon, even if Kamui hasn't done it in the manga yet or ever. Kanon says, how could Nataku imagine dying for her would bring her joy, anything but pain? If he was willing to give his life for her, then why? And she thinks she knows what Fuma's desire is. This is where we get this whole discussion of losing sight of what matters most. Lucy and I have discussed this huge, important, unanswered X question. What matters most? Is it love? Is it respecting other people's choices? Is it choosing to live on out of respect for other people's love for you? Kamui thinks that if someone close to you dies, you almost die of sorrow, and we know that the best explanation Yuto or Sonata can offer for why not to kill is because someone would mourn. Subaru says there is no one way to make everyone happy, but is there a wish that could do that? So Lucy, I really wonder if the end could have to do with Kamui giving up his powers.
Mm.
We're told again and again that Fuma's powers are tied to his, that whenever he learns to make a kekkei, Fuma will learn something too. And, quote-unquote, as long as Kamui is Kamui, Fuma cannot come back. I keep thinking that means Kamui sacrificing himself. But maybe it is just relinquishing his role as the Kamui and eliminating the powers on either side, letting the Earth decide for itself?
Yeah, I have always really been struck by that. I think it's the line where it's as long as Kamui is Kamui that you just said. Like, it makes it sound as if he could back off from being the Kamui and then it would back Fuma off from being the other Kamui and maybe things could be okay.
Yeah, I really wonder about that, too. Because it could also simply be that the big answer here is to desire happiness for someone else. To make your wishes not out of a selfish desire, but a selfless one. To understand that we have to find a way down the middle. Kakyo even brings up this kind of Buddhist middle way thought when he says that as long as humans cannot give up their selfish attachments, the Earth and mankind will be destroyed. Is wanting Fuma back selfish because it would destroy other Kamui, or because it would be restoring someone to a life he could not enjoy, as Subaru implied when he warned Kamui that knowing he killed his own sister would destroy Fuma? Interestingly enough, our friend CJ Jockin also wondered if overattachment to humanity and complete lack of attachment both fuck you up. Is there a happy medium?
Yeah, and because I went down my like tarot card rabbit hole, kind of have like a theory that the cards hold a key. I think the three missing tarot cards give us some pretty strong clues to how the ending might go. Again, it could go anyway. We have no real way of knowing, but this is fun to think about. Of these three cards, two of them, the sun, which is associated with renewal and happiness, and the world, which is associated with change and freedom, are usually read as unambiguously good signs, which most cards are not. There's this whole thing where if you flip them upside down, some people interpret them with a reverse effect, but whatever. Most of the cards can kind of go different ways depending on how you're reading them, and that depends a lot on, like, this is getting in the weeds of tarot, but, like, when you're looking at the cards, which symbols, like, jump out at you and which jump at the person doing the reading and blah, blah, blah. Anyway, there aren't that many cards that are, like, more or less unambiguously happy. And then sandwiched between these two cards in, you know, the order is Judgment, which is focused on reunion and second chances. And these all feel like very positive things, especially in the context of this story.
Yeah.
I think one way or the other, we are going to see a reunion between Kamui and Fuma. And I don't think it's going to be as dark as the other endings that we've seen from all the other various versions of X. I really feel like they're building to something that's actually happy. Maybe happy in a similar way to Reg Veda, which means people may still die and it may be super sad, but ultimately Kamui and Fuma are probably going to be together or at least have moments together. I want it to just be happy. I just want a happy ending. I don't care.
Yeah. I also want a happy ending. I really dig that interpretation that you have. I think that's really awesome.
I'm excited. Whether or not it happens, whether or not we ever know. So when we watched the X anime with our friends and family before, you know, doing the episode, we got a big thumbs down for them when it came to the end. Caitlin Like was very focused on the foils for the characters and really wanted to see that version of duality play out so that, like, maybe each dragon of heaven was able to turn a dragon of earth and that would help resolve things, which I could see. Like, there are some parallels there. And CG Jockin brought up the action versus inaction a lot. Is making a metaphysical choice an action? Isn't that what Kamui is suffering from? The fact he can't do what his choice begs him to do? Does that mean he made the wrong one or his convictions aren't strong enough?
Or question mark.
And this is the thing that also I kept coming back to, but is it a classic Greek tragedy? If so, what is Kamui's fatal flaw?
Yeah, what do you think there? Because, like, there is the potential that this thing is not intended to have a happy ending.
Mm-hmm.
That it will have a, that, like, Rig Veda has a happy ending by Clamp standards, but it is sort of a, like, smiling through your tears kind of ending. What if this one is the opposite, where it's an ending that is happy for everyone but Kamui and Fuma?
Yeah, well, and thinking about fatal flaws, like, if Kamui had trusted his friends and gone straight to them and gotten the sacred sword, like, their dad would still be alive, well, maybe. And perhaps a lot of things could have gone in a different direction. Like, when we were reading it first, I think I mentioned at the time that felt like the first point of no return. Like,
yeah,
when he was killed, they couldn't unkill him. Like, they had gone in a direction that couldn't be undone. I mean, I guess you could argue that began with Saya. Like, once that happened, you couldn't undo that.
Yeah.
So, I don't know. Like, if he has a fatal flaw, it may have been not trusting his friends who were his reason for, you know, wanting to protect everything. Like, not trusting or not, like, acknowledging that they were so important to him that he had to include them in his choice.
Not thinking about their feelings.
Mm-hmm.
That he wanted to protect them in a selfish way, where he wanted to fight for them and show off his strength and not involve them, but didn't even consider asking them what they wanted.
Mm-hmm.
I think that may be the fatal flaw, and I think that may tie in very neatly to some of the other stuff we were discussing.
Yeah, I think that makes a lot of sense.
I think that one of the reasons that our friends were so kind of, like, dissatisfied with that ending, and not to just put words into everybody's mouth, but we're winding this down here. In a post-Madoka world, self-sacrifice for the world in a narrative is being seen in a less positive light. It's being seen as more of a cop-out, or even something gender-coded as being expected of women. And I wonder how much it changes if you see a man sacrificing himself, other than how much that brings you right back to the Christian Bible,
yeah.
Right? But it all makes me think about endings in general, Lucy. How many long-running TV shows have ended recently in a way that was so disruptive or unsatisfying to viewers that it almost ruined them in people's eyes? How do you write a satisfying ending for something long and complex and full of ups and downs that are meant to keep you hanging on for years? What can be big enough, impressive enough, profound enough? Especially if you think you're trying to stay ahead of fans guessing your ending, which I personally think is an unnecessary fool's errand.
Mm.
Writing legend says that Flannery O'Connor said, "Endings should feel both surprising and inevitable. That is, they should come from enough planted logical evidence they don't feel like they're just totally out of nowhere deus ex machina, but also not too predictable," which you can accomplish sometimes by using red herrings and sleight of hand, like not bringing up a theme or statement for chapters and chapters after suggesting it early on.
Mm.
But ultimately, audience reactions are subjective. What works for one person won't work for another because we had different experiences, preferences, and expectations going in. I think that endings always have the potential to disappoint because they're artificial. If you carefully wrap everything up, it can feel too contrived, whether it's happy or sad. In real life, there are no endings. Maybe when everyone is dead and forgotten, you could say stories end, but that's such a far-flung hypothetical. One person's death is just an event, however important, in other people's lives. No one is a main character. It's an ensemble cast. Having everyone die in a story can feel satisfying to some, even if it's sad, because it is so final. For others, we just are focused on whether a narrative has a clear thesis and makes a bold statement, and if it's too ambiguous or contradictory, we may feel dissatisfied. But again, what would be big enough here to bring everything together? Lucy and I talked about the kinds of things we might do given what we know and what we would like to have, but we're not Clamp. Mm-hmm. For now, all we have is this quantum state of ambiguity. Our ideas and every stalwart fic writer or essayist are all equally valid, and even when Clamp do finally show us how it ends, the validity is still tangible since we kept alive this idea of different possible outcomes and the power that has to give us hope in real life.
Yeah, and much as I really hope that Clamp finishes this, like, partially for them, like, I hate having unfinished projects, especially unfinished projects I know people are wanting. So I hope for them they're able to finish it, and I would hate for them to write something that kind of they were just trying to fit into what they had originally planned and didn't fit them now, but I really like to think that the ending that they have in mind would still work, and still work for readers, but also still work for them. But all that is to say, there is something profound about where it leaves off, with big questions unanswered and none of its future predictions confirmed. It is left, in the words of Kotori, her own prediction remaining the truth for us readers. The future is yet undecided. Wow, so, Robin, this is our last X episode, huh?
It feels so weird to be at the end of it, after spending a literal year of our lives talking about it. Of course, we're not really done talking about it. We know these characters will come back again in Tsubasa along with everything else. And maybe one day we'll be able to talk about the actual end of the manga. We can dream.
In February, we'll be discussing Miyuki-chan in Wonderland. We'll probably do the manga and OVA in one episode, and then we'll start Ray Earth. Moving forward, we plan to keep with this pattern of one volume per episode like we kind of discussed earlier. We've learned our lesson. We're moving on this way.
Yes. I'm really excited about Miyuki-chan. Yes. I think I need to see Babes. I'm ready for Babes. I'm just ready. I'm so ready.
I'm ready for Fluff. Oh my god.
Until then, you can follow us on Twitter, Tumblr, and Instagram at ClampcastPod, on Facebook as Clampcast in Wonderland, and on our website, clampcastinwonderland.com.
If you'd like to support us financially, you can join our Patreon, where we release bonus episodes on non-Clamp series like Odon High School Host Club, They Were 11, or Tenchi Muyo. You can also check out our bookshop.org store, where we have some curated recommendations for you. And of course, there are many kinds of support, and just a review or recommendation to a friend can go a long way, and we are also just always so happy to talk to people on Twitter or anything, so just, that is also very supportive for our emotional well-being.
Which we could all use a lot of that kind of help these days. Mm-hmm. Thank you for coming with us on our journey through Clamp's Wonderland.
Until next time, remember that everything will be all right.
And try not to lose an eye.